Welcome to the Advisors Radio Show on the Next Stage Business Radio Network. Building, growing, and maintaining a business requires a team of professionals to guide you to the best decisions. The Advisors Show will break down the important topics for small business in today's changing economy. Sponsored by Executive Suites of Minnesota, offering 4 locations in the Twin Cities for office space leasing and virtual office space for the growing business owner. Now, here's your host, Pamela Muldoon.
And welcome once again to the Advisors Radio Show, right here and only here on the Next Stage Business Radio Network. So great to have you along, and we appreciate you. If you're listening live today, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy day here in your business week to check us out. And if you catch us later and it happens to be on our archive or download or on demand, however you want to say that, we appreciate you checking us out. Of course, we're all of the social forums and our iTunes channel. So we're very easy to access as long as you know we are out there. So if you like the good work we're doing, we also encourage you to share this with your other business friends, business family members, whatever the case may be. Because we here at the Advisors Radio Show, we are one of many programs now active on the Next Stage Business Radio Network. So be sure to check out our webpage at nextstagebusinessradio.com for additional programs that we continue to add to the platform for specific areas of interest, from job search and job transition to conflict resolution to networking. We just have multiple shows on our platform, so please do check that out. And, of course, a big thank you to our show sponsor, Executive Suites of Minnesota. We do this show out of the state of Minnesota. And Executive Suites of Minnesota, 4 locations for virtual office space or leasing office space here in the Twin Cities area. And find out more by going to exsmn.com. So we're going to get going as we always do, just dive right in. You know, the Advisor Show is meant truly to be that place of good quality information and resources for the small business community. As small business people, whether you're the owner or running a department in a small business or engaged in any way, shape, or form, just having access to good quality information is something that's so important to you. And today we are doing that. We're actually touching on a topic that really infiltrates many nerve centers inside of a business. And so I want to welcome to the show not only one, but 2 legal advisors from Mansfield Panic & Cohen. We have Jeff O'Brien. Welcome, Jeff. Good to have you on the show again.
It is great to be back.
Excellent. Always wonderful to have you. And, of course, you have a business attorney associate on board with you today, because we're talking intellectual property. And we have Greg Perlberg as well from Mansfield Panic & Cohen. Hi, Greg. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on board.
Absolutely. And this is going to be a good and timely, it seems like it's timely every day as the internet evolves and as conversation evolves around this. But we're going to do some foundational conversation. Jeff, before we get Greg looped in, I just want to, again, as we welcome you back to the show as a legal advisor here, not only for Advisor Show and Next Stage Business Radio, but with Mansfield Panic & Cohen. Our show today is Intellectual Property for Small Business. This is truly an important piece to the puzzle, and I know it was really important, and one of the great value adds of having Mansfield Panic & Cohen a part of the show is to have other attorneys that you can tap into. But as a business attorney in your own right, IP is extremely important, but it's also important to have another associate that you work with that talks on this on a very specific basis. So why don't you just kind of kick us off on the importance of intellectual property as we get going here, and then we'll loop Greg in. Get a little bit of your background, Greg, and how you play into not only the role at Mansfield Panic & Cohen, but in our conversation today.
Well, Pamela, in terms of the importance of what Greg does, when we're going to talk about trademarks and copyrights and patents, in terms of the importance of what those things mean for a business, to me, having, your trademarks registered or patents filed or, copyrights, all these things protected, is probably as essential as having an assumed name filing or your articles of incorporation or articles of organization filed with the state. This is skeletal framework for your business enterprise just as much as the organizational documents. And I think it's probably more often overlooked than the organizational documents. And I think part of that comes down to it is a little bit more pricey for, to register this stuff. But what a lot of business owners miss is, yes, there's an expenditure of funds to protect your trademarks, and whether it be a logo or a slogan or a name or anything, those things. But number one, those things are essential to the brand you're going to build as you get starting out. And number two, it does create an asset instantaneously for your business. And so that's when Greg joined us a few years back at our firm. I was so glad to have him here, because I know enough about some of these things to be dangerous. I know enough to spot that there was a piece of IP that had to be protected. But in terms of the nuts and bolts and the nuances of what to do, that's Mr. Perlberg's area of expertise, and I'm so glad to have him as a partner here to be working with our new clients. And literally, we have a lot of new business clients that they will have in their first consult. They'll meet half the time with me and half the time with Greg, so we get all the bases covered.
Excellent, excellent. You're absolutely right. I mean, obviously, a lot first with setting up that best business entity, but this becomes, and I think it's always been this way, but even more so with the reach that business can have today, such an important part to the startup and then growing process of a business. So, Greg, as we officially welcome you to our platform today, I want you to give us a little bit, Jeff teed you up very nicely there in terms of this is an area of expertise or an area that you've really focused on in your legal career, and you bring some great experience as well as some other opportunities to the table. So tell us a little bit about what you do as an intellectual property attorney, and then we're going to start breaking down some of those specific definitions, copyrights, trademarks, patents. We hear a lot of this stuff, but we don't always, decipher what they all mean. So share a little bit about yourself, if you would.
I will, and thanks. It sounds a little bit like The Wizard of Oz, patents, copyrights, trademarks, and the Yellow Brick Road all the way there.
Oh my.
But, which is a great chunk of intellectual property litigation in and of itself, that whole Wizard of Oz genre. But my background,
right.
I came from, the electronic product development and online publishing world. I was with the Old West Publishing for a number of years, and I spent over 7 years at IBM. And during the course of my career, I've been the chair of the State Bar Association's Internet Law Committee, have worked with the American Bar Association's Cyber Law Group. I've taught trademark courses at some of the local schools. I currently teach copyright and music publishing for the McNally Smith College of Music, which is a pretty exciting opportunity for me because I'm actually on the front line of developments in this entire changing space of what's happening in e-commerce with music, with file sharing. I've got, I'd say, over 500 gigs of what I would say in quotes, lawfully downloaded music. But these are all becoming big issues for business owners. And so my clients include software companies, startup businesses, all sorts of e-commerce entities, lots of creative individuals and companies like filmmakers, musicians, authors, songwriters, and we are expanding, and I think Jeff and I are approaching this in tandem. We're representing restaurants, breweries, all sorts of interesting companies that have these large repositories of intellectual property. So we're doing things from not only forming the companies to give them the protections that corporate veil provides, but we're prosecuting trademarks. We're doing these sophisticated software as a subscription agreement. We're coordinating patent resources, and we're enforcing contracts and employment issues like confidentiality. What do you do when employees ebb and flow from your business? How do you protect your trade secrets? So the number of issues just seems to be growing and becoming more, intersected in terms of what and how our practices have overlapped, Jeff and mine. And I think that's why we've kind of filled a nice niche in terms of what we do.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. And of course, in the wonderful world of business in today's content-driven world, I mean, we're a perfect example sitting right here on an audio platform providing content, which is technically the intellectual property of Next Stage Business Radio. But then it starts to get a little muddy, right, when you can actually share it on such a universal platform like the Internet. And so I'm one example of a business owner dealing with this, but of course there are thousands, if not millions, of folks in today's world, from blogs to articles to ideas that are getting uploaded day in and day out. And so I want to, we'll probably end up having, Greg, this will be part one of the conversation, because something tells me that we could have part two, part three, with we're doing this show here in June of 2011. And just in the lower hours, of course, Apple has now introduced iCloud. So what does that mean, right? And just it's just an amazing time to be dealing in what used to be, intellectual property had a specific place, and now it seems to be all over the place, or our stuff is all over the place. So let's tackle some of those terms that are the bare bones or foundation of this conversation and just kind of break down some of those definitions, because our audience may be dealing with a couple of these or maybe one of these depending on their personal situation or business model. So would you be kind enough to break down the difference there, Greg? Copyrights, patents, trademarks, just kind of in your layman terms, what do those really mean, and why should I as a business owner know these definitions?
Sure. And what we do, and we work with anything and everything involving the protection and, I guess, the commercial exploitation of these sort of creative properties or these intellectual properties, which run the gamut of things from inventions to artwork. But if we break it down, we've got a couple big categories or buckets of intellectual properties, the first being patents. Patents, trademarks, and copyright all fall under federal law or federal registration procedures, that sort of thing. And so what we're talking about here applies largely throughout the U.S., and if we talk about any state subtleties, we'll sort of carve them out separately. But patents are these new and useful inventions, things like features of software, business methods. They have to be things that are novel, never done before. They have to be non-obvious, something new. Generally not an issue in terms of trying to interpret what that means as far as whether something is patentable or not. It's just whether it's novel, new, non-obvious. So things that are patentable are things like processes, machines, business methods, again, believe it or not, clothing, accessories, and designs, a lot of Internet innovations, games, and then there's even some patent protection for things like odors and plants. Now, what is not subject to patent protection are things like music, photographs, a number of things that really don't provide any invention type or style of utility. Now, what patent gives us, it gives the owner of a patent essentially 20 years of monopoly protection. So there's some very strong rights that we reward inventors with who create something novel by allowing them to essentially exclude others from practicing their invention for a limited period of time, which is generally 20 years for a utility patent. And if you actually infringe on someone's patent, you're looking at lost royalties, lost profits, price erosion. You can recover your attorney's fees, and depending on the willfulness of it, you can actually collect triple damages. So it's a very powerful form of protection that is certainly finite and fixed in time. But if you combine it with things like trade secrets and trademarks and copyrights, you start to create what we call a picket fence, or a collection of intellectual property that's both licensable, can be commercialized, without a lot of concern about the expiration dates, because you, in theory, have stacking chunks of intellectual property that keep coming into fruition that extend the intellectual property of your business. And I think a staggering fact that's out there these days is the fact that back 10, 20, 30 years ago, the bulk of a company's value was determined by its hard goods, its machinery, those sorts of things. Now we have 70 to 80% of the value of a company being associated with its intellectual property. And these are the things that we register with the U.S. government or that we keep secret. So the landscape has really changed. There are some just a quick comment on patents. There are some serious considerations to keep in mind when looking at patentable inventions. So you do want to be careful about inadvertent disclosures. You want to make sure that you're watching patent activity in your industry. You want to make sure you're dealing with the appropriate employment agreements and the work being done by independent contractor agreements. And you want to be sure that there are some very specific timelines for both U.S. protection and international protection that you need to be wary of. So in the world of patents, it's usually a very good idea to speak with a qualified patent attorney in terms of some of your specific considerations. Jeff, anything to add on patents?
I don't think so. Patents are, to me, they're extremely valuable. What would you say, Greg? They're probably in terms of budget-wise for a new business owner, it's probably the priciest thing to get, but probably the most powerful, because I mean that really they really do have value to possibly others, competitors or others in the space that may want to acquire those patents or acquire a license to use those patents. Would you agree with that? In terms of the spectrum, they probably are the most derive the most instant value depending on the nature of whatever is being patented.
That's very true, and they can take time to get. They can take up to 3 years to potentially have a patent issued. There are some strategies to think about, like getting a provisional patent, which is sort of a preliminary sort of one-year holding spot for a patent. Some of the benefits of that is it actually marks in time the date of your invention so that you can actually keep or at least defend your position that you invented it first in the event there's another similar invention that comes somewhere in that time frame. So there are some things to keep costs as reasonable as possible, but it can be from a few thousand dollars to tens of thousands of dollars to take a patent through its final form of issue through the prosecution process. But again, you're essentially granted monopoly rights, so everyone in your industry has to come through you, and so it can be a very lucrative form of royalties and license fees and that sort of thing. So we've worked with some interesting patents in some of the sporting goods space, some pretty interesting tools. So it seems that there's still a lot of cool inventions being created to this day. One of my other favorite categories of IP are trademarks. So these are distinguished from trade names. So typically you pick a name for your business. So our business is Mansfield Tannick & Cohen. But we also have a trademark for our business called the Incubation Center. And so that's the adjective that defines a set of services that we provide. And so a trademark can be a brand, a logo, a look, or a feel that's associated with a particular good or type of service. It's really meant to create a heightened sense of source. So when you think of, my particular car manufacturer is meant to convey a sense of brand quality. I get a little bit of a bad time here with how much time my car spent in the shop lately. But when you see the car's name or the logo, you think of a quality of high quality, good customer service, good performance. There's lots of fabulous trademarks out there, like, for instance, A&W for delicious root beer or Nike for quality tennis shoes. These are all forms of brand equity that are typically registered with the United States Patent and Trademark Office that essentially protect the goodwill associated with your business. And so it helps keep customer confusion out of the mix. It's a powerful tool for enforcing things like internet domain names, and it's a great way to establish that kind of sense of brand equity. Now, registration of trademarks is not required, but there are just a ton of advantages with registration. It locks in a priority date. It gives the world notice that you're using this trademark in commerce, and it lets you enforce your rights against infringers. So not only do you get the little circle R symbol, so the circle R symbol is something that you get when you actually get the registration notice from the federal government. You can use the TM for hard goods, and you can use a little superscript SM for services that you might provide on an interim basis or if you don't register with the government. But it is powerful to get that little circle R because it gives you some strong presumptions of ownership, and it gives you great constructive-wide notice that your mark is being used for your particular class of goods and services, which is a great deterrent with respect to competitors. And it's a basis for foreign registration. And like, for instance, in the sporting goods space, if someone is bringing in from a foreign country some counterfeit goods or treading on your trademark, you can actually work with the Customs Service to prevent the importation of infringing goods, which is a great enforcement tool. And again, you have the ability to collect your attorney's fees. It's very expensive to potentially litigate IP infringement claims. So the fact that federal protection gives you these tools and these enforcement rights is a great resource. Just in terms of sort of tips around selecting trademarks, we always try to encourage clients to think of strong, distinctive marks. So there's this concept called the spectrum of distinctiveness. So generic terms typically are not trademarkable. And then if you go kind of further to, I guess, the left of the spectrum, you've got things like suggestive marks like copper tone or rollerblade that have strong protection. You've got arbitrary marks, which are trademarks that really have nothing to do with the underlying goods and services. So a great example of that is Apple, or Yahoo, or Grey Goose for vodka, or Target for retail services. And then you've got fanciful, so you've got suggestive, arbitrary, and then fanciful marks, which are literally made up words like Kodak and Exxon. And those provide the strongest level of protection and enforcement, and it helps keep the registration costs down. So when we work with our trademark clients, we always kind of help them through that brand selection process. So your trademark can be the same as your trade name or your company name, or you can have a whole series of trademarks that are owned by your company. So it's really a business decision at that point. So in the case of Nike, both their company and their brand is Nike.
Sure, sure. And, well, and actually, as you're breaking some of this information down, Greg, I've got a couple of things that are running through my head. And I love the examples of, you know, some, you know, we're audio, so we're talking about some great visual examples that all of us have heard or seen, you know, from Nike. I know you and I have talked as well about Coca-Cola has multiple ID from not only their logo and the red ribbon look to the bottle, right? Even the shape and the silhouette of the bottle is an intellectual property piece for them. And so now let me ask you, in terms of a small, medium-sized, or startup business that's putting all of this together, and this kind of goes to this process of, you know, Jeff, a lot of times you go to someone like Jeff and get the entity, get, you know, started, that beginning stage of growing. When, as a business, should I really start considering some of this trademarking? I think sometimes in the first year or two, you're just so busy, your head's down, moving forward, growing the business, that this is a piece I would think gets missed. Is there a time when I'm having the conversation with either someone like Jeff or yourself where it's time to start that discussion or start moving on that process?
Well, the risks are potentially greater the more successful your business comes. So there's a couple of considerations. Things like internet domain names. So if I'm looking at Incubation Center or Mansfield Tannick and Cohen, I want to try to collect up as many internet domain names as I possibly can that kind of flow and are natural sort of typing variations of my potential trademarks. The risk for a lot of small business owners is, and we'll use the A&W example, if you start a business called A&W that sells something other than, you know, hamburgers and root beer, and you spend several years in the marketplace, you potentially are at risk for your profits if you are found to be infringing on another mark. So let's say hypothetically you're selling an A&W energy drink. A&W, the owner of the root beer mark, comes back in. They can collect your profits for that period of time that you were infringing upon their mark. So the risks become greater or more costly the more successful and profitable you are. So before you are in a position where you're at risk for infringement or an expensive rebranding campaign. We've worked with restaurant clients, for instance, that have had to go through and bring in the giant cranes to replace restaurant signs and reprint menus, change websites, because the mark they selected is infringing upon someone else. So going through the quote-unquote clearance process early might seem an unnecessary or a luxury item in terms of forming your business. It really does save a lot of, you know, litigation or defensive type costs down the road. And again, I would use the example of the restaurant. The cost of making those changes was, you know, a huge expense, particularly, you know, for a restaurant business where, you know, profits are, you know, always, you know, sort of ebb and flow. And so early on in the process, it makes a tremendous amount of sense. Along the internet domain name side as well, once you start registering things like trade names with your state Secretary of State office or start doing some searches on the internet or start putting some names on a website, there's a pretty good chance that someone out there is going to be trolling for your good ideas and will gobble up things like internet domain names and try to sell them back to you. So instead of having to negotiate with them and spend, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dollars for an internet domain name that matches your mark, you can potentially just go into GoDaddy or Network Solutions and secure those internet domain names early on in the process to kind of tie up the loop as far as your trademark rights go. I hope that answers your question.
So, No, it is. It's good. I think it's, you know, what I'm hearing is a really fairly simple actionable item right there is you've got your name or your core name, and now, you know, spend some time making a list of possible domains, you know, basically possibly how other people would search and locate you, and start to purchase that process. Because you work in an area, Greg, where I think people are hesitant to invest up front, but on the back end, the cost can be such a large piece if they aren't proactive. You're dealing kind of a what-if scenario. And so I think that's a real simple, actionable way of starting that process if you're really not sure what avenue you want to take. But now, Jeff, I have a question for you in terms of when you're helping a business do that startup process of entity, name creation is a part of that. Are you, you know, you've mentioned that it seems 50% of the time at the very least, they're also starting to sit down with someone like Greg. I mean, is this becoming really a part of the startup process for you in terms of a business attorney who gets things up and running for business?
Absolutely. If I could just concur with one thing Greg said about, you know, signs coming down off of restaurants or, you know, even gets simpler than that, you know, startups are on tight budgets. Wouldn't it be terrible to have to throw out all your brand new letterhead and business cards because you get a cease and desist letter from someone who has a trademark on the name of your business or a logo that's similar, all those things. So I mean, you know, from the marketing standpoint, Pamela, if a business is starting out and is you know, really thinking and each step through logically, they're going to start with a business plan, and included in that is going to be their marketing strategy. And so at the same point, you have to – my view is – you have to be doing that clearance on if you're going to have a logo or a phrase or a name that's going to be critical to your business. You need to be making sure that that's, you know, Greg talks about the clearance. You need to make sure that's available and get that cleared before you even think about setting up an entity and moving forward with a business. I mean, you really have to be doing this at the business plan stage when you're analyzing what's out there. And to make sure that you aren't running afoul of somebody else's protected marks.
Well, I've got a fabulous tip to go along. One of my fabulous tips to go along with that is if you're in the business planning stage and you've not yet launched or you're just getting ready to launch, in addition to grabbing up domain names, which you don't have an obligation to use. Now, trademark rights are based on using them in interstate commerce on a regular basis. There was a law change a few years back that allows you to file what's called an intent to use application with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And so you can actually reserve a trademark for up to 36 months by filing it online. So if you've got this great idea, you've got this great fanciful mark or this great suggestive idea, you can actually register it. And the registration fees are not particularly outrageous. The interesting thing about the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office is it's relatively self-funded. It's not funded through taxpayer dollars. So the filing fees you pay go into paying the salaries and, you know, keeping that operation going. But the filing fee for a trademark, for a single class trademark, is typically $325. That's the governmental filing fee. There's typically some legal massaging of the application to be sure streamlined through the process as best as possible. But in terms of an investment cost, it's not overwhelming in terms of the launch of a new business. So, you know, again, we strongly recommend looking at that. You will get cease and desist letters if your trade name infringes on someone else's trademark. So if you start a business called Nike Apparel, Nike will likely send you a cease and desist letter. So, yeah, again, clearance is very important.
Well, and I think that's a really great tip, and I'm glad that you shared a little bit of some of this entry cost, because there's probably a myth. A lot of times you get folks in your offices that think just getting this started is going to cost thousands and thousands of dollars, and really what you're saying, Greg, is to start this process and put a little protection around, even if you don't have the concrete ideas all formulated yet. It's a real, real easy entry point for a serial entrepreneur. It really is. So,
and I think as part of our incubation.
Really important.
Oh, and I'm sorry for talking over you. I'm still working my way through internet radio.
No, go ahead. Yep.
As part of our incubation center suite of services, we'll generally prepare and file a trademark, including all the governmental fees, for right around $850. When we get pretty good at drafting these applications to hopefully get them into the system to a point where they don't end up with a lot of what we refer to as obstacles during the prosecution process. There are cheaper ways to file trademarks. Jeff and I end up sometimes having to untangle some misregistrations, so to speak, to try to get them cleaned up and back into the process. So, you know, kind of thinking in, you know, that ballpark of dollars is typically realistic. I would say, you know, most law firms charge anywhere from where we charge up to several thousands of dollars to prepare and file a trademark application. So, yeah, definitely something to include in the business plan.
Excellent, excellent. Well, what we're going to do very, very briefly is take a break, hear from our friends over there at Executive Suites in Minnesota. And, guys, when we come back, I want to make sure we also touch on some of the mistakes that small business owners make in this process. So hopefully by having mistakes on the table, we can all learn from those so that our folks listening don't make those same mistakes or at least know how to get them corrected if they have. So you are listening to the Advisors Radio Show on the Next Stage Business Radio Network. We've got Jeff O'Brien and Greg Pearlberg. Both of them are attorneys with Mansfield, Tennick & Cohen. We are talking intellectual property for small business. Great to have you along. And we're going to be back in just a bit. Again, this is the Advisors Radio Show on the Next Stage Business Radio Network.
Starting your business was one of the most exciting decisions you've ever made. Finding office space, that should also be an exciting decision. Executive Suites of Minnesota will ensure locating and choosing your office space is not only exciting, but the perfect fit just for you and your business. Whether your need is a single office or multiple offices for your growing company, Executive Suites of Minnesota offers the turnkey office space solution, personalized telephone service answered by a real receptionist, high-speed internet, administrative support, fully furnished reception and kitchen areas with 24-hour access to your private office, meeting and conference room rental also available. Four convenient Twin Cities locations, Edina, Woodbury, St. Louis Park, and downtown Minneapolis in the IDS Center. For photos and contact information, go to exsmn.com. Executive Suites of Minnesota, exsmn.com.
And welcome back to the Advisors Radio Show on the Next Stage Business Radio Network. I'm your host, Pamela Muldoon, talking today with two legal advisors, and we're dissecting that ever-popular topic, intellectual property for small business. We've got Jeff O'Brien, business attorney with Mansfield, Tennick & Cohen, and, of course, also Greg Pearlberg, business attorney, we'll say intellectual property attorney with Mansfield, Tennick & Cohen as well. And before we took a short break there, we were just kind of breaking down some real easy entry points into making sure that you're doing some smart protection for your business. And we touched on this as we were talking, Greg, about some of the different elements of intellectual property, and that is some of the mistakes that folks make or some of the things they should have in place but they may not be doing. And then, of course, the repercussions of that could be lost ideas or stolen ideas or, you know, of course, it's a financial loss as well. So what are some of the most common mistakes business owners are making when it comes to their intellectual property?
Well, and if I can, I just want to digress just a little bit and just give a quick overview on copyright, which are those original works of authorship, so things like books, photographs, movies, sound recordings. Just coming from McNally Smith this morning, I'm still kind of hot on the music topic right now.
Again,
another source of protection by federal law and constitution. But one of the mistakes that a lot of business owners do, it's really difficult to get our arms around this, but the internet is really meant to free up information or free up communication, but at the same time, the internet is just packed full of copyrighted material. So let's say you're writing a book about recipes or some a website about recipes and that sort of thing, and you go around the internet, you grab pictures of various types of food. Let's say you grab a picture of sheep for lamb-related products and cows, and all these photographs are subject to copyright protection. So you're actually infringing someone's copyrighted works when you're pasting them onto your website or when you're grabbing and throwing content from other third-party sources. So it gets to be a very tricky area as to what you're actually building as far as is it actually yours. And so we have a lot of clients who get these demand letters for payment from some of the companies that own these repositories of images and other online content. So just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's free. And so when we talk about copyrights, we're talking again about musical works, photos, to a large extent software, elements of websites, some elements of architectural works, and as well as the sort of compilations and collective works of all of these things, and of course things like motion pictures and all that sort of good stuff. Price of copyright protection, cheap. Typically an online application is $35 in terms of governmental filing fees. We just helped a client protect its kind of collection of blogs and forums through a single filing with the Copyright Office. So as far as, you know, early on mistakes, I think that's one area of concern. We talked about infringing upon things like trademarks and trade names, but the other is just be careful when you're building out websites. The information really isn't that free. And if there's a question about it, our rule of thumb is always clear it. I always ask for permission.
And when you say,
what I mean by that.
And okay, so the clearing of it is wherever you got it from. You know, because I hear this from other folks that are out here on the interweb, and, you know, again, you start, there's a whole, well, free in our economy is not a brand new phenomenon, but there the extent of the ability to have something at no cost or providing something as an entry point into your business, you know, whether it's a free ebook or, you know, just free information or, you know, you talk to software. There's usually a free level and then there's, you know, pay-to-play levels. And so, and a lot of this is done as part of a beta into something bigger. So is, you know, how has that kind of affected the whole intellectual property? Sometimes the ability to put it out there so much faster and easier is not necessarily the smartest way to do it either.
You know, that's true. I think the issue often becomes will you get policed and caught for what you're doing if it in fact is infringing on one third party's intellectual property rights. And so there's a business risk in terms of how much and how you try to protect and clear all of your intellectual properties. But there are some strong elements to even our clients' websites that are out there. So we really work with clients to try to help them kind of protect the look and feel of some of their online intellectual properties. And so there not only do you have things like trademark and domain name protection, but you've got this concept called trade dress, which is this sort of look and feel. So, you know, the look is this, you know, the site's visual design, colors, layouts, fonts, shapes. And then the feel is kind of what lies underneath the interface design, how it kind of works. And so whether you can protect those under copyright or trademark law is often kind of a question mark. But if the look and feel is inherently distinctive and acquired a secondary meaning, so when you see it, you think of brand X. If it's non-functional, not subject to patent protection, and it's not confusingly similar to someone else's goods and services, there's an element of trade dress protection that we work with a lot of website owners to try to capture. So you end up trying to make a decision between copyright protection, trademark, trade dress protection. Again, not particularly expensive in terms of overall cost, but critical in terms of trying to enforce your rights. And so it's very difficult. We've worked with a number of clients who've tried to work with or asked us to help them get infringing content off others' websites, which the more registration, the more enforcement tools you have at your disposal, the better equipped you are to do that. Jeff,
well,
I don't know if we want to talk. Oh, go ahead, Pamela.
Well, I just had one thought.
No,
give the listeners a thought about trade dress, if you want to visualize a very common object, a product out in the marketplace where there is a claim of protected, you know, an element of trade dress or protection, Coca-Cola. The Coca-Cola bottle is one that the Coca-Cola company believes that's their, that kind of hourglass type look to their bottle is theirs. That's their trade dress. And even now they've poured it over. You buy anything from a small little glass bottle all the way up to a plastic 2-liter at a grocery store. They have that same distinctive look compared to that's different than other bottles. That's, correct me if I'm wrong, Greg, but they consider that trade dress.
That absolutely is a registered trade dress, which is a form of trademark. And the cool thing about that is if you actually are successful in registering the look and feel of the trade dress, that's perpetual protection. So in the design world of patents, you have a 14-year window of protection, but in the world of trade dress, as long as you continue to use that shape of the Coke bottle in interstate commerce and continue to register every 10 years, you have perpetual protection, which is an incredibly valuable asset to a company. A quick side note on Coke. They also have this recipe to Coke, you know, their secret formula. So we have a fourth bucket of trade secrets as well called trade secrets, which are really protected under state law. Most states apply trade secret laws uniformly based on the Uniform Trade Secrets Act. But these are things that are like the recipe to Coke that they keep secret. They're competitively significant information. And as long as you keep them secret, they get thrown into another bucket of intellectual property. And so this is going back to your question about mistakes that businesses or employers can make. It's not protecting trade secrets to the extent they can. So they're not marking things confidential and proprietary, or they're not limiting distribution to people that need to know that information. So it's a combination of physical and technology-based safeguards, non-disclosure agreements, non-compete agreements for key employees, just making sure sort of the chain of title and the proprietary nature of all of this information stays with the business. The comment we use is once the cat's out of the bag, you can't get it back in.
Right.
So that's always a big concern we have. It's not a softer form of intellectual property, but it's sometimes more difficult to enforce. And, again, anything that's got the word litigation attached to it creates a huge cost
right.
for any business.
Right.
So Jeff and I try to help businesses stay out of
Yes. Right. It's not a happy word. It's just whether you're on the receiving end or having to do it, it's costly, takes up a lot of time and resources. And again, what you're referring to is being as proactive as possible so that that particular concern is alleviated as much as possible. And there were a couple of things you've mentioned as we walked through this conversation. From kind of that proactive protection, but all the way through, I like how you mentioned kind of the chain of command. So whether it's an idea, a trade secret, so that could apply to like a process inside your organization that is specifically done by you for your clients, or you know, is kind of could be a process, it could be software, making sure all those key players are at least brought to the mill in terms of protection. And you mentioned this non-disclosure agreement a couple of times, Greg. Will you just elaborate a little bit exactly how the non-disclosure works? Because this isn't just inside the organization. This could be for any external, possibly venture capital or folks that are helping get a product launch off the ground, you know, that need to see the invention or the specs or whatever the case is. So can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Sure. And, you know, we always recommend using a up-to-date non-disclosure and confidentiality agreement that not only defines what the confidential information that's being disclosed is, and you talk about what the authorized use and purpose of the confidential information may be. So in the investor world, you can use our financial data for considering an investment in our company. That's the narrow scope of use for the confidential information. You often list exclusions from confidential information, and this is typically when you're on the receiving side of information. So if another company asks you to sign a confidential agreement, you want to make sure that things that are already known to the public don't somehow create some additional liability to you if you disclose it as well. But you always are very clear to enumerate the obligations of each of the parties, particularly the receiving party. So you've got, you know, you want to make sure independent contractors are bound to similar confidentiality agreements to the extent that they're provided access to information. You want to make sure that you define what the length of obligations are. So again, trade secrets are one of those types of protection that can be perpetual in length. So as long as the recipe to Coke or the secret sauce for Kentucky Fried Chicken never gets out, that form of protection lasts indefinitely. So if you see a non-disclosure agreement that has a 3-year term but doesn't have a carve-out for extending that time frame for trade secrets, that can be problematic, particularly if you're the owner of that trade secret, because in theory that trade secret then can be used by the receiving party after 3, whatever the term that's defined in that agreement looks like. So not all confidentiality agreements are the same. There's sometimes pretty tricky provisions in those, but they're a pretty valuable tool in terms of enforcing your trade secret rights. The other sort of contractual piece to this is these work-for-hire agreements. So a lot of companies use independent contractors or website development companies to put together copyrighted content, to help them with brand selection, all sorts of things and tasks associated with the business, and a company might not be ready to bring on employees at the particular stage. A lot of intellectual property doesn't get assigned back into the company, even if the company pays for it, unless there's some sort of written agreement that says the company owns it. So a lot of issues have come up with clients where they're potentially raising capital and there's some due diligence going on, they're trying to sell the company, what have you, and we have to go back and kind of clean up all of that intellectual property. We deal with a lot of assignments, and a lot of times it's difficult to find those web developers. Sometimes the web developers won't do it without additional consideration, cash. So these are issues that are cheap to deal with on the front end of this equation, much more difficult to deal with on the back end.
Well, and okay, again, the more you talk, the more questions I have, Greg. And this is always fun, the fun part of the advisor show is I'm just as much a business owner as I hope my audience is in terms of the stuff that you're saying and the things that kind of come to play. Now, you mentioned web designer a couple of times, and I know there was something that you shared with me in a previous conversation talking intellectual property, but a lot of times we don't realize that without these agreements in place, we talked a little bit about non-disclosure, but just understanding who owns what. And so I think there's a lot of activity going on in terms of independent consultants or freelancers doing work, but people aren't realizing that the person doing the work may actually own, quote unquote, your website or your content or that type of thing without actual written release of that information. Can you touch on that, since you brought up the web a couple times, or at least the development of websites and the importance of making sure that your contractors are truly contracted?
Oh, sure. And so let's say, just come up with a hypothetical. Let's say if you've got a website dedicated to raising sheep and farm animals, and you've got some proprietary techniques on, you know, the agriculture industry, those sorts of things. If you hire a web designer to build that website for you without strong contractual provisions in there that say all of that web content, number one, should be owned by the business owner, but number two, that web designer shouldn't create a similar or competitively similar or materially similar website for one of your competitors. So regardless of what industry you're in, whether it's high tech, agriculture, restaurant services, what have you, you want to make sure that when you pay someone to build something for you, one, you own it, and you want the words work for hire, or at least you want some simple language that says you as the business owner own the material provided to you. And then secondly, that they don't do things that are, you know, confusingly similar. You know, that you may guide that web designer to the greatest website design ever made, and without some restrictions, it's very possible that then you'll find variations of your website all over the internet, which really dilutes your potential trade dress. Creates, you know, we've used terms like blurring, tarnishment. You know, if you've got a a very wholesome set of goods and products that you're selling, and we find that there's an adult industry site that's got the same look and feel based from the same web designer, you've got a problem. And to deal with that after the fact can be very costly. So two things
well,
you want. Oh, go ahead.
No, I think that's so important because I think it's an area, a lot of work gets done and it gets done efficiently, and folks aren't, you know, some of these really smaller micro businesses aren't realizing that contract also really needs to have that ownership piece in there. Now, is this a contract, just out of curiosity, that I as a business owner should make sure my freelancers are signing, or is it something that the freelance independent consultant should have as part of their contract just their process when they set up a new client, or does it come
well,
from both
funny,
sides?
Well, it's funny, Jeff
runs
into this all the time, that if I'm representing the freelance independent contractor web designer, I will want that web designer to potentially retain ownership and essentially provide you a license to use that content, maybe even on a subscription basis. So a lot of the forms you see are kind of middle of the road, or they don't answer a lot of questions as to ownership. And so it really I think from a business owner's perspective, it's a nice, you don't need a lot of these sorts of agreements, but you need, you know, a basic employment agreement for your employees. You need a basic non-disclosure agreement, and then you need this sort of kind of services agreement that lets you go off and procure things like web design or architectural services or whatever the case may be. And these aren't particularly complex or spendy to create. They're relatively standard. And I think one of the things that Jeff and I have tried to do over the years is try to come up with sets of agreements that are well received by both parties, that aren't fraught with a ton of extra negotiation and expense in trying to get these things signed, but, you know, are a clear roadmap to who owns what happens if there's a dispute, when dollars get paid. You know, so it's just one of those, you know, again, incremental business costs of getting your enterprise off and running.
Yep. And Jeff, this is really part of that initial contracting process. I know that this is, you know, once you get the entity and all those fun things set up, contracts is really an initial phase of where you're working with your business owners as well. So then that may bleed over to that conversation that we need to have with Greg.
Absolutely. And, you know, all these things intertwine with each other. You know, Greg was talking about non-disclosure agreements. Suppose that you have a business and you have some trade secrets or something, and you're trying to raise money from investors to pull off the business concept. You may be you're not going to just show your business idea, your protected information, to a third party without some type of agreement not to use it or disclose it. And so we have a lot of clients that, you know, we might be hooking them up with funding sources, and the funding source that we bring to the table is asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement prior to seeing what the idea is or the product is, so that it doesn't, you know, so that our client doesn't, you know, let the cat out of the bag, so to speak. And I always talk about that movie Flash of Genius. It was out a couple of years ago, about the guy who invented the variable speed windshield wiper. And there's a scene in that movie where he pulls up to the Ford plant with this thing retrofitted onto his Ford Galaxy or whatever it was, and turns it on and shows it to him. It ended up being a huge court case, whether or not that was because all of a sudden Ford started having these things on the cars. You know, that's an example of someone of where, why you don't just run up to the door and show why you have the next great American invention without some type of protection from someone taking it from you.
Yeah.
And that really is the risk, Jeff, that if you have a good idea and you don't protect it, someone else will exploit it, if not steal it from you outright. And so that's really what we're after, is just trying to protect the equity of business owners early on in the process.
Well, and I think that's so important. It's why we do our show. It's why we started the conversation where we did today. And, you know, we're coming down to the wire on our show this round. It always goes so fast for me. I hope my audience feels the same way because I'm just so fascinated, especially this particular topic. I know, Greg, if you're game, I would love to have you on again and talk a little bit more about the music side, the publishing side, and a side that not only a history of yours, but both of those industries have just changed and exploded in, you know, from ebook to, you know, file sharing to all these types of things. And I know a lot more folks in business with the content-driven model that we do in marketing in today's world. This is something that we all, regardless of size of business, need to stay engaged in and have a good intellectual property attorney or law firm that's connected to our business so they can guide us to the right process. So I'd love to have you on, Greg, again sometime soon and just kind of tackle that end if you're open to it.
Oh, absolutely. We'll talk about some topics like fair use, when you can actually use other people's intellectual property. So we'll probably play some samples with next radio show, add some additional content, and talk about how we're able to do that sort of thing and what business owners can and cannot do, and kind of maybe stretch the boundaries of what's okay and permissible.
Right. And I think it's a big question mark right now for folks out there, as we are able to create things so easily and so efficiently and share so much out there. how do we still continue to own what's ours? How do we get to share that which we're okay sharing and just understand that line? And so as we wrap it up, we just have a couple of minutes. Jeff, I just want to let us know again how we can connect with both Greg and yourself in terms of more questions, more connection. You mentioned the Incubation Center, which is a wonderful program, especially for the startup small business owner that's looking to grow. How can we connect with you guys? What's the best way to do that?
Well, we've got our website, mansfieldtanik.com, which is, of course, linked on the Next Stage Business radio show website. And then our general number here is 612-339-4295. And I think we mentioned, you know, these issues are you're dealing with federal laws. So whether you're listening in California or Minnesota or Wisconsin or Texas or wherever, but you need a good trademark copyright attorney, you can give us a call. We can hook you up with Mr. Perlberg.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, Pamela. We have clients in all over the U.S., in Japan, in Europe. So it's you know, not that we do things any differently or any better here in the Midwest, but we've just been able to kind of cultivate a nice national and international practice.
Absolutely. And we are grateful to have both of you as part of our advisor, legal advisor piece of the advisors radio show on our team. And thanks so much for joining us, Greg. I know we've just kind of tapped the surface on some of this. I look forward to our next conversation.
Fabulous. Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. And Jeff, as always, always great to have you on and share your side of the advisory fence. And I'm sure that we'll be talking with you again soon on another legal situation that needs to be tackled for small business.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Awesome. And, of course, you, our listeners, we appreciate you being a part of this, and we hope that we covered some basic information in terms of intellectual property for you today. Of course, we're just going to have to do this more because I know I've got more questions, and you probably have more questions. So we'll bring Greg and Jeff back on in a future show and scratch more of that surface around intellectual property for small business. In the meantime, do as Jeff said and check out our website. You can get all the protection information there for our advisors team and our partners and the folks that are involved in all the programs at Next Stage Business Radio Network. That's nextstagebusinessradio.com. And we're also out on the social web. So we have our fan page out there on Facebook. We have a Twitter at NSB Radio Network. We also have a group out on LinkedIn. So go ahead and search us out under groups, Next Stage Business Radio, and you will find us. Join the discussions with the advisors and other hosts of our shows and just members of our small business community out there. We also have our channel on iTunes, so check us out there and download us to your MP3 player, iPod, iPad, iPhone, whatever the case may be. And I think last but definitely not least, you are listening to us on the Blog Talk Radio platform. So definitely follow our show if you haven't done so already. And you will stay up to the minute in terms of our shows, what's going on, when they're on live. And, of course, everything's on demand. So you can check us out at will when you have time to listen. Thanks again to our sponsor, Executive Suites of Minnesota, with 4 locations here in the Twin Cities, virtual office and leasing office space. We appreciate them being a part of our show. And you can find out more at exsmn.com. So we encourage you to do that. As always, thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading us. Please share the good work that we do with your business friends and associates. We are here for you. And our hope is that we're always providing something in some way, shape, or form that will help you be bigger and better in your business and possibly a little bit smarter. So hope you're having a great day. And as always, make it a great week.
This has been a presentation of the Next Stage Business Radio Network.